Well, these pages are, in fact, just one page of the book of Revelation, that which was read to us just now in our reading, Revelation chapter 6. A question. What is black and nasty and just around the corner? Answer? The future. It is a bit sick, isn't it? It's actually a Czech joke. Very popular in Czechoslovakia just a few years ago. Czechs in bars and cafes would repeat it to one another. What's black and nasty and just around the corner? The future. Since the events of last year, I imagine that in Czechoslovakia that joke has gone out of fashion. They can tell jokes instead about their political leaders, as we do, in their newfound political freedom. In fact, one of the Sunday papers the other day had a half page full of jokes about Mr. Gorbachev, which had been gleaned from various Russian journals in recent months. I enjoyed it enormously at the time. I shan't bore you with it now. If the Czechs are not looking at the future anymore in that kind of despairing cynicism, many other people, in one way or another, are. Not just when considering their own country and its future, but as they look at the direction in which the whole world appears to be heading. Not so long ago, I think you'd agree, the current and dominant fear was that of nuclear war. The memory that in Hiroshima in 1945 a quarter of a million people died led to dreams, nightmares, and any number of nightmare predictions about what would happen if the world's nuclear stockpiles were set loose. And for the moment, it seems that those fears at least seem to have subsided somewhat. But in that place, coincidentally or otherwise, have come premonitions of ecological disaster, which have gripped the mind of the person in the street as powerfully as those they've replaced, and certainly more powerfully than anyone might have predicted even just a few years ago. Not a coincidence, I think, that we are approaching the year 2000. It's not that the approach of the millennium leads only to heightened pessimism, though, about the future of our planet. In other circles, including anything touched by the so-called New Age movement, the effect is exactly the reverse. Optimism, confidence, as the future approaches. A new age is said to be dawning, in which all will be peace and prosperity, wars will be no more, the very best elements of civilizations in East and West will be combined, and the product will be a smiling, united, happy humanity. Now, whether you take an optimistic or a pessimistic view of the future, most people are concerned, if at all possible, to know something about it. And in this concern, the Bible comes in some very real measure to our aid. It gives us no moment-by-moment blueprint to the unfolding of history, and many precious hours have in fact been wasted through failing to realize that. But it does assure us of certain things about the future, in order not to satisfy our curiosity over details, but to enable us to live well and as we ought and wisely, to know with confidence where it is that we've come from, to know where it is that we are going to, and to know who is in control. It was Jean-Paul Sartre who wrote that everything that exists is born without reason, prolongs itself out of weakness, and dies by chance. And it's because it rescues us from the meaninglessness of that kind of closed and random universe that the perspective that the Bible introduces is of such tremendous importance. The chapter we're considering tonight comes from this last book, the book of Revelation. It's a curious book in many ways, and you could say that it's a hazardous territory. Unless you know how to read the map as you travel through this book, you're likely to get lost down any number of highways and byways. At the same time, it is especially valuable as a corrective to some of the weird and wonderful ideas about the future that arise from time to time, our own time, I think, being no exception. It is a book which is marked, interestingly, both by extreme pessimism and by extreme optimism. It places no hope in man and in his efforts at self-preservation, which it seems is doomed to failure, but it is rock-solid certain about the ultimate intervention of God and the ultimate triumph of good over evil. And tonight, being in chapter 6, we focus, I'm afraid, on the more pessimistic side of John's vision. The other side comes in the next chapter. But even so, we will touch on that brighter side as we draw to a close. Now, there are two things here which John is concerned to impress upon us, and which we must grasp from what he writes in chapter 6. The first of these things is, as he looks down history, John is telling us, in the name of God, that things will not get better. And the second thing is that things will certainly come to an end. First, then, that things will not get better. We're introduced in this sixth chapter to these interesting gentlemen, the four horsemen of the apocalypse, well known under that title. John is describing the scene in the heavenly control room from which the drama of history on earth is directed. He is showing us the power, the plan that's at work behind the scenes. And in that plan for human history, these four horsemen of whom he writes in this chapter have a very significant part to play, and I hope you'll find it interesting to look at them and see what it is that they're up to. The first of them is white. We find him in verse 2. I saw, and behold, a white horse, and his rider had a bow, and a crown was given to him, and he went out conquering and to conquer. Well, why white? White is the colour of victory. In the ancient world, a white charger was a natural animal for a victorious general to ride. The symbolism is fairly plain, and it's not surprising, therefore, that we're specifically told what he's about. He sets off on a mission of conquest. So it's not hard to see in this first white horse and its rider the spirit of what you might call imperialism. John, of course, is writing at the time of the Roman Empire. And it may be that he has another empire in mind, the Parthian Empire, which caused a lot of bother to the Romans on their eastern front. It may be that he has that in mind because you'll see the weapon that this rider carries. The rider has a bow, which apparently was not normal for the Romans, but was very regularly in use from their enemies, the Parthians. So it may be that he's got two empires in mind, Roman, Parthian, and symbolically every other. Empires, after all, rise and fall. I think there was a British one once. Anyone remember that? In the late 1980s, have seen the death throes, after all, of the Soviet Empire, which people slightly optimistically describe as the last. The white rider and the white horse seem to embody this spirit of imperialism. What of the second one? Well, he's bright red. Verse 4. Out came another horse, bright red. Its rider was permitted to take peace from the earth, so that men should slay one another. And he was given a great sword. Bright red, possibly symbolic of blood. In fact, it probably almost certainly is so. The purpose of this horse and its rider is to take peace from the earth. Now, you might think this was slight piece of duplication. Hasn't the white horse already done that? In his crusading spirit, maybe we have duplication of labour. Maybe somebody ought to have a word with the four living creatures who seem to be in charge and recommend a little time and motion study. Seems to be a duplication of effort. Well, I think not, because empires, for all their violent aspects, are well known also for bringing peace in their wake. Certainly the Roman one did. Only because of that was Paul able to travel from one end of the Roman Empire to the other relatively safely. And the red horse seems interested rather in violent revolution, in a spirit of anarchy and of civil war. His purpose is that men should slay one another in a kind of internecine conflict. And of course, alongside imperialism, history knows of any number of such events, occurrences, violent revolution and civil war. In fact, looking around the world today, you've only to mention Central America, haven't you, or Lebanon, or Ulster, as we were praying just now. Despite everything, maybe there is still a threat of it in southern Africa. And even the Russians are worried about the prospect. The second horse, then, bright red. The third one is black. Now, he's a little harder to identify. I saw and behold a black horse, and its rider had a balance in his hand, and I heard what seemed to be a voice in the midst of the four living creatures, saying, a quart of wheat for a denarius, and three quarts of barley for a denarius, but do not harm oil and wine. Well, it all seems to hang on that phrase in inverted commas. A quart of wheat was a day's food, would keep you going for a day, and a denarius was a day's wage, roughly speaking. And barley was cheaper and not quite so nice, so you had three quarts of that for the same price. So here is a voice representative of the society from which it comes, calling out the price of its food and intending to hang on to it. Some have seen here a reference to famine, but I think that's probably rather unlikely. It doesn't seem to speak of famine conditions. Inflation might be nearer the mark. There is enough cash in hand to feed the family. But there's not a lot left over. But you see what the voice does want to spend the leftover money on, and that is the oil and the wine, which is not to be harmed. Quart of wheat for this, three quarts for that. But do not harm oil and wine. I think this is not so far from our own society. Oil and wine are not luxury items in the ancient world. They're those little extras, those little creature comforts, which, as people say, make all the difference to life. And the phrase seems to be the cry of a sort of self-indulgent society, which is unbendingly materialistic in its expectations, unwilling to let go of its oil and wine in order that others may have just enough wheat to live on. There's not a lot of spare cash, but they're very sure that any that's left over is going to be spent on just those few little things that make life worth living. In fact, putting this into 1990, we might say to Mr. Major, well, sir, do what you like to the economy, but don't you dare tax the fags and the booze. And the rider of the horse, you notice, carries scales in his hand, and he seems to be weighing up this society, this world, and finding in it an unequal distribution of resources. Some who have enough and are unwilling to sacrifice for the benefit of others. There is the black horse of economic injustice. And the fourth one is sort of anemic. Let's have a look at him. Verse 8. I saw and behold a pale horse, and its rider's name was Death, and Hades followed him, and they were given power over a fourth of the earth to kill with sword and with famine and with pestilence and by the wild beasts of the earth. He's translated here as being pale. In fact, if you were to see him, I think he would be a sort of greenish yellow. Now, there is a horse to enliven your imagination. He looks, in fact, like death warmed up. And that, in fact, is what he is. Its rider's name was Death, and Hades followed him. And as well as by sword, he kills by these things, famine and pestilence and wild beasts. And death occurs under his visitations on a vast scale. He has power over a quarter of the earth. That figure, it seemed a bit incredible in days gone by. Seems less so today, doesn't it, when you think that a fifth of the world is constantly on the edge of starvation? When you think that some African countries could lose a third of their populations in the AIDS epidemic? Maybe this picture of an anemic, death-carrying horse is not so far from the world as we know it. So in these four little creatures, John is telling us that certain things will stalk mankind as long as history continues. Imperialism, revolutionary violence, economic injustice, plague, and famine. And certainly if the 20th century is anything to go by, he's right, isn't he? And so humanistic optimism, with its attendant dreams of a man-made utopia and a paradise on earth, will disappoint in future generations as it always has in the past. We cannot say, as the proponents of the New Age want to say, all is well and it is getting better. It is not and it won't. Now, the end may be far, far away. Scientists may continue to find answers and alleviate many problems. But you see, according to John's vision here, mankind will never find peace because there will be war to the end. We will never defeat disease because there will be plague to the end. We will never establish economic justice. There will be poverty to the end. We will never abolish hunger. There will be famine to the end. And supremely, we will never abolish death, because people will be dying till the end. One of the marvellous things about the Bible is its realism. And it's true, of course, that the same Bible which tells us these things commands us also to love God with heart and soul and mind and strength, and to love our neighbour as ourself, to do all within our power to alleviate poverty and injustice and famine. But it reminds us that when we've done all that, our own power will not have been enough to banish these things from God's world. Only he himself has the power, when he chooses, to do that. And that is what he will one day do, which is the second thing that John has to tell us. Though he is sure that things will not get better as long as history continues, he is equally sure that things will certainly come to an end. And the second half of the chapter speaks of two groups of people which represent between them the whole of mankind, and which are both seen in the light of the end of time. The first group is longing for it. As it happens, they've died. They are the Christian martyrs here who have died out of faithfulness to Jesus Christ. We find them in verse 9. I saw under the altar the souls of those who had been slain for the word of God and for the witness they had borne. They cried out with a loud voice, O sovereign Lord, holy and true, how long before thou wilt judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell upon the earth? And they were each given a white robe and told to rest a little longer. They are longing for the end. They're crying out for justice to be done. And the one they address, you notice, is the sovereign Lord, the holy and true one. And their complaint is that he has concealed his holiness in history. He has let sin and evil run riot in the world, and he has not intervened in his holiness to judge it. And this is not pique on their part. Many will have died, as Stephen did, asking forgiveness for their executioners, but justice must one day be done. And it's not only Christian people who say this, is it? Often people with no Christian faith at all may well say, well, if God is really there, why does he not intervene and do something about it? And we find here that he surely will. But they are told, not yet. They must wait a little longer, because others are to go the same way. And then the end will come. One of the marvellous things about believing in Jesus is that the end is in sight. You know where you're going, and whatever surrounds you now, you know that that is where you will arrive, at rest, at peace, and in his presence. And for that, the first group is longing. It cannot come soon enough. I wonder if you recognise that perspective in your own experience. It is the peculiar possession and birthright of Christians. The second group is taken by surprise. Verse 12. I looked, and behold, there was a great earthquake. And the sun became black as sackcloth, the full moon became like blood, and the stars of the sky fell to the earth as the fig tree sheds its winter fruit when shaken by a gale. The sky vanished like a scroll that is rolled up, and every mountain and island was removed from its place. Then the kings of the earth, and the great men and the generals, and the rich and the strong, and everyone, slave and free, hid in the caves and among the rocks of the mountains, calling to the mountains and rocks, "Fall on us and hide us from the face of him who is seated on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of their wrath has come, and who can stand before it?" The description of the moon becoming like blood and the falling of the stars is doubtless symbolic in some measure, but it certainly describes a real end to the cosmos as we know it. Someone I know who experienced an earthquake described it as being like 15 steam trains passing simultaneously underground and overhead. I found it quite terrifying, but they passed. This earthquake does not pass. John here looks to the end of the world as we know it. And what happens? Well, it's an interesting fact, isn't it, that in passing verdict on people, history pays no attention to their status, their position, or their wealth. None whatever. All that is of interest is their character and the sort of people they were. Napoleon's power does not impress us at this distance, any more than the poverty of John Bunyan disturbs us. It is quite irrelevant. People's only concern is with what they were like in themselves. And so on the last day, as John portrays it, distinctions between people vanish. You see, the rich and the strong, the slave and the free, all alike, whoever they may be, are confronted with the wrath of the Lamb. I don't know if that struck you as an extraordinary phrase when you first heard it. When did you last see a little lamb angry? And yet it is so, because Jesus is the Lamb of God who died for the sins of the world. And yet his death in history does not remove the reality of the wrath of God. What it does do is provide us, rather, with a place in which to hide from that wrath and find security, to find the hiding place of which the psalmist wrote and of which we sang just now. And the only hiding place from the wrath of God on the last day is Jesus himself, the one who says and said, "Come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest." And to those who come, he proves to be the hiding place which they need. They love him as that first group. They sing of him. They long for him. Here they've even laid down their lives for his cause. But those who don't come, those in the second group, will find, according to John on that day, that there is no hiding place from his displeasure. The great day of their wrath has come, and who can stand before it? That is one of those questions which the Bible asks, but is quite unable to answer. Who can stand? Indeed, who can? Can you? Because our response to Christ is not, as so many think, of marginal importance. John is not telling us that the last day is a day of compulsory heaven for all. And this second group invokes the mountains themselves, "Fall upon us and hide us from the face of him who is seated upon the throne." Here then, you see, is extreme optimism represented in one group, and extreme pessimism in the other. As to which group we belong. Because if we are not ready for heaven now, as Carrie was saying earlier, were she to be run over by that bus, there is no way that we will be ready for heaven then. By that time it will be too late to make up our mind. But it is not too late today, because the Lamb of God died so that we might be forgiven and be sure of our place among those who will spend eternity in his praise. When I was sitting in a library earlier this week and looking at this chapter and thinking about these things, I noticed on the door of the library a sign, obviously in an exam term, saying, There are no reserved places in heaven, and there aren't any in this library either. Well, it may well have been right about the library, but thank God it is not right about heaven for those who have trusted and believed.